Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 11th of November, 2020, and you're listening to Reconstruction with me, David Taylor from Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of our online news service. It's Armistice Day, Phil. Are you wearing your medals?
Unfortunately, I have not even got medals for swimming, never mind anything important like valour and bravery and service.
No, I can't. I haven't either. The only ones I've got were ones which were left to me by my father. We shouldn't be too flippant about today, because it is quite an important event. In fact, on Sunday, we're listening to the radio, and at 11 o'clock, my daughter, who's 21, everything went quiet for a minute or two, as it tends to on Remembrance Sunday. When everybody started talking again, my daughter said, "I wonder if people will still be doing this in 100 years' time." Good question, I thought. I'd like to think that they would be. But so we observed it anyway. So what have we got on the menu today then, Phil?
Well, industry politics seems to be the... industry politics, industry organisation, the role of trade associations and what they're doing, and industry leadership.
Yes.
And the things that self-appointed leaders want us to be doing or think we should be doing, I suppose, might be the theme of the week.
Yes, indeed. Yes, leadership is definitely the key word there. And there was one particular story this week, which I noticed, and I instantly knew when this story broke that you would have something to say about it, because you've been quite outspoken about it in the past. And this is the plan by certain people in the industry to try and introduce, it's a campaign, isn't it, to try and introduce a licensing scheme for building professionals and tradespeople, something which you were very critical about when it was announced to begin with. And there's actually been quite an interesting development, hasn't there?
Well, they've dropped it. The people who are campaigning for a builder's licence to be a mandatory scheme for anyone involved in the building trade, they've not completely abandoned the aspiration, but they've effected what they're calling a tactical pivot.
Yeah, lovely phrase.
So they're turning their focus, instead of pushing for an overarching licence scheme for builders, they're throwing their weight behind the Trustmark scheme, a government-backed kite mark, which some builders have signed up to. And the reason why they, or the relevance of Trustmark in this is that we've got the Green Homes Grant scheme going on for a few weeks, a couple of months or whatever it is. And in order to be an installer for home improvement work under the Green Homes Grant scheme, you have to be Trustmark registered, which has given wind in the sails of the Trustmark organisation, and some more organisations have signed up to Trustmark. I asked Trustmark last week, sent them an email saying what are the latest figures, how many more people have signed up. They haven't told me yet. I suspect if it was lots and it was going really well, they might have been quick to tell me how great it was.
Yeah,
there's still a relative dearth of companies signed up to Trustmark, it seems to me, whether that's for the Green Homes Grant Scheme or any building work that you might want done. You can go to the Trustmark website, search for someone to work on your gutters in your house or bathroom fitter, and you won't get the widest of choice coming back. I dare say that the people who are Trustmark registered are all the creme de la creme, and I'm not dissing the scheme or the companies registered for it. It just hasn't got the penetration it requires to be properly meaningful. And I think the people behind the builder's license scheme are saying, well, let's put our weight behind trying to make Trustmark work better. And it's been going for 15 years now, Trustmark.
That long? So let's try and realised.
Yeah, huh. Let's try and give that a push instead of campaigning for a license.
I mean, I think that is actually a far more sensible thing to do. We spoke about this a little while ago when the government announced its Green Homes Grant we had a look online, didn't we, at the Trustmark website to see who was actually available. If I wanted my gutters done or my boiler done or whatever it was, I seem to recall that there are only a choice of about four people within a radius of 100 miles of my house who could do the work.
Well, I think since we last spoke, there has been, particularly on the Green Homes grant scheme, the boiler type stuff and insulation, there has been an upswing since then. But it has been very much focused on that type of work rather than on someone you might want to tile your bathroom or whatever.
But this licensing task force idea was far more far-reaching than the Trustmark. I mean, the Trustmark is like a sort of a stamp of approval, isn't it? But this was far more onerous, the scheme which they were proposing.
Any jobbing builder, self-employed, any building company, anyone who wants to, and it was narrowed down. Initially, I thought it was any building work at all. The plan had been slightly refined in the past year to be working on the fabric of a house. So if they're putting up your garden shed or building a patio in your garden, or, you know, ground workers, they'd kind of decided not to include them, I think, and they'd focused on the people on the house, which makes a bit of a nonsense, because
rather arbitrary, isn't it?
Your domestic customer of building work is going to be just upset if your patio's done badly as if your hall flooring's done badly, I suspect. But they seem to have focused on the definition of building work being the fabric of the house, or the fabric of the building, I should say, because it's not just for houses, it's for any building.
But it wasn't just jobbing builders who came within the remit of this proposal, was it?
It appeared to be from everyone from Balfour Beatty to Bob the Builder, all the way down, so long as Bob the Builder was trading on his own and wasn't an employee. If you're an employee of someone else, you don't have to get a personal licence. You just have to get a construction skills certification card to work for Balfour Beatty or on one of the main sites. But they would have to have the proposal as was being developed was that any jobbing builder would have to have they'd have to pass the test effectively. Yes. They'd have to have their work approved, not just like a driving test where you pass your test once and you've got a card for life. It would have to be every 3 to 5 years.
Yeah.
And you'd have to pay anything from a few hundred pounds to £1,000 for the privilege every time. And if you think of how many hundreds of thousands of people work in the building trade, and most of them, or at least half of them, are self-employed, the bureaucracy involved, that was my main concerns were the humongous bureaucracy, and even more than that, the woolly thinking behind it. I mean, the idealism behind it was that it works in other countries. I think in Australia and New Zealand, you have to have a builder's license, and they've got that there. But I mean, we've talked about this before. The driving force behind the idea, it's been a campaign, particularly the Federation of Master Builders have been pushing it for some time, on and off, and a lot of it it grew out of the various campaigns over the years against what we pejoratively call cowboy builders.
Yeah.
Because they think builders have got a bad name. They want builders to have a better name and people be able to trust their local builder. And all of this good stuff. And it's a perfectly good sentiment to drive out the rogues and the crooks. But as we've talked about before, there are just as many rogues and crooks at the top of the industry.
At the respectable end.
exactly. The stock market listed FTSE 250 house builders who are leaving homeowners in tears with all the defects that they've invested their entire, not just their life savings, but their next 40 years worth of life savings.
Yes.
You know, huge great mortgages. And the idea that one of those major house builders who are leaving homeowners and their customers distraught would somehow have their license removed is a nonsense. Mm. The people who put up the cladding or specified the cladding or sold the cladding on Grenfell Tower, for example, and all those other high-rise buildings with flammable cladding systems, I mean, would they lose their builder's license because they've been proved to be inept, incapable, incompetent? No, they wouldn't.
No.
I mean, there may yet be prosecutions involved there, but it seems to me that while they're gunning for the cowboys with this scheme, they're not necessarily thinking it through as what the entirety of the building industry's problems are.
I think that's the thing. It simply wasn't thought through properly. And it's rather surprising that so many people rallied behind the idea. And in fact, I have to say, you are the only person I've ever heard actually make these points. Everybody seemed to accept the idea that it was good in principle. And I've seen very little comment about it elsewhere except on our website.
Well, the National Federation of Builders came out against it very quickly on the bureaucracy ground, saying we've already got training standards, we've got the health and safety executive, we've got the planning laws, we've got tax laws and this, that and the other. And the amount of bureaucracy that your local jobbing builder has to go through, the problem is not too little regulation. Mm. If anything, our biggest problem is too much regulation. It's just not joined up.
Yeah.
And so that was the National Federation of Builders' perspective, from the bureaucracy and the cost. What surprised me, though, is that it doesn't seem to have been picked up in a huge way by the construction trade press.
No.
I think we're the only people to have reported the demise of the scheme, or should I say the tactical pivot of the scheme, of the campaign, I should say. Whether that's because the rest of the construction trade press knew it was nonsense from the start and thought it's not even worth reporting on, or quite why they're not interested in all of this, I'm not sure, because it was going to affect the B2B end of the construction industry,
yes,
as well as the domestic side of it. It was right through the chain, was the proposal.
But tactical pivot wasn't exactly trumpeted, was it? It was they haven't sent out a press notice about it. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you found out through their newsletter that you subscribe to.
Exactly that. Anyone who's interested in knowing more about the scheme, and I was, so I said, yes, keep me informed on what's going on, please. And I got a newsletter, the regular newsletter, I think it's a six-monthly thing, last week, saying that this is the new direction, the new strategy. But there's nothing beyond that on either the campaign's website or the Federation of Master Builders website, or at least there wasn't yesterday, last time I looked. Now, I suppose that has to change at some time. Bottom line is, you can tell, is I think it's good news, but I actually think that the good news that they are dropping the campaign, and I think the more they looked at it, the more they saw the difficulties, and they've got one of the people on the task force is a civil servant from the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, a chap called Fergus Harrodons, and he basically sort of said, you're not going to get much support from government in this. You know, essentially the government is not keen on more regulation and this sort of thing. And despite evidence to the contrary over the past few months, they still have relatively free market sensibilities.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly a construction licence, a builder's licence, is anything but free market. It's protectionism to try and create a barrier to enter to the industry and to make it harder for people to do business.
Do you think that was the main motivation, Phil? Because, I mean, obviously nobody likes a rogue builder. It was a bit sort of motherhood and apple pie. You know, you want to drive out the rogue builders, so who wouldn't get behind this idea? But do you think the Federation of Master Builders had a hidden agenda? They basically wanted to introduce a new barrier to entry so that it would benefit their members.
Well, their members, they at the bottom end, they compete or provide services in the home improvement market quite a lot, and they are up against the self-employed jobbing, man down the pub,
who man in a van,
maybe professional and have his name on the side of the van, or maybe someone who's perhaps semi-retired and doing a bit of odd jobbing, or maybe a complete doesn't know what he's doing but is quite handy, or
yes,
the full range of skills that they may have. And they, I think, feel that it's difficult to compete with someone who, if they are self-employed and not VAT registered, and that there's always this assumption that, if you pay cash in hand, if you're not paying VAT, somehow you're doing something dodgy or wrong.
Yes.
You're only doing something dodgy or wrong if you pay cash in hand and not paying the VAT, if the person you're paying is VAT registered and providing, VATable services.
Yes.
If the person doing your work is the chap next door who makes, you know, 50, 60 grand a year or 20, 30 grand a year under the, whatever it is, under the VAT threshold by doing decorating or odd jobbing or home mm-hmm. repairs, there's nothing wrong with not, in fact, there's no VAT to pay them.
No, exactly.
You've still got to pay VAT to B&Q or Wix or whatever it is for the paint and materials, you or they are getting. But there's no VAT on that. But that requires, that creates immediately a two-tier industry, a two-tier yes. supply side.
Yeah.
And that's another FMB campaign, which I actually fully support them on this one, and I think it's a much sounder campaign they've got, which is the RMI, you know, building, repair, maintenance and home improvement should be 5% VAT registered, yes. not 20% VAT registered, to equalise that, because you've immediately got this. It makes no sense to me, unless I am prepared to be crooked and naughty and pay cash in hand and not pay the VAT. Pay the VAT. it makes no sense to me to go to anyone who's VAT registered for a simple job, like, you know, putting in a cat flap or some decorating works, just a top coat or whatever. I mean, clearly, if I'm building an extension, I want a proper building company. If there's anything in any way, you know, major or I've got any concerns mm-hmm. about, I'm going to go to someone who knows what they're doing. They've got a track record, references, paperwork, and I quite like to see something like a trust mark or an FMB membership badge as well.
Sure. Yeah.
But most jobs aren't like that. Most jobs are, you know, quick and easy and relatively simple.
Yes. But this campaign to make RMI work 5% VAT registered has been going on for years, hasn't it? I mean, I don't know if it'll ever get anywhere, but I agree with you. I think that's it makes perfect sense. It's puzzling, really, that the government appears to be deaf to it. Presumably, it's because the VAT revenue coming from RMI work is something they don't want to relinquish. I don't know. But anyway, if we've misinterpreted the FMB's motives in all this, then clearly we'd welcome some correction if they want to get in touch with us, which they can do on podcasts@theconstructionindex.co.uk. So are we ready to move on to our next topic, Phil, which is a related topic?
Sort of related, isn't it? More industry politics.
Well, it is, yes.
And that chap from the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy I mentioned, this civil servant, has got a foot in this next story as well.
Yeah.
Which is all to do with the Construction Leadership Council.
And everybody knows what that is, don't they? Probably
do they?
Not.
I bet they don't. I bet they don't.
No, exactly.
It's Construction Industry Council, isn't it? No, it's not the Construction Industry Council. It's Construction Leadership Council.
Yes, yeah.
Different thing.
But it is a talking shop, isn't it?
It's not meant to be. It was
no, I know it's not meant to be, but... Okay. Yeah, all right then. Yeah, tell us what it is then, Phil.
Well, it was meant to be when the Construction Leadership Council was set up, and I'm trying to think when that was. Was it 2013?
2013.
It was essentially a panel of business leaders from the construction industry, handpicked by the construction minister at the business department, whatever the Department of Business and Enterprise happened to be called then. Mm. It wasn't DTI, it hasn't been DTI for ages, but whatever the Department of Business was then.
Yeah.
So this panel of bosses, handpicked, so that the minister had a sounding board to be advised on policy. It's a two-way thing, really. And the business leaders could talk to ministers and say, that might not be a good idea because, and you might want to think about this, and that would be a better thing to do, to improve the government's understanding of business, I think, primarily. Mm. And hopefully to provide some leadership to the construction industry of the direction it should be going.
I understand that it was the idea of the Construction Leadership Council was to actually implement recommendations which had been published in a report in 2013, I think it was. It was the Construction 2025, which seems to set a deadline, going from the title, with various aims and goals within there to sort of improve things like cost reduction, efficiency improvements and stuff like
it was,
that.
It was reduce cost, reduce carbon for, want of a better word, be greener and cleaner.
50% reduction in greenhouse emissions. Is the target there.
Well, they're doing quite well. We talked about this before. They're doing quite well on moving in the right direction on that. They're moving in the right direction on cost reduction. Where they're absolutely tits up is trying to reduce the balance of trade deficit in construction goods and materials.
Because you ran a story about that in July, didn't you? Which was...
I believe so. And that just continues to go in the wrong direction, even though, you know, the pound has the value of the pound fell and British goods were cheaper to export. And we have exported more, we've just imported even more. So the import-export thing has been quietly forgotten about by a lot. You don't really hear a lot of the Construction Leadership Council chatter about, oh, we've got to really, you know, push on the trade. It's all about green and about cost and modern methods of construction.
Yes.
And anyway, the story of the Construction Leadership Council this week, while we're talking about it.
Yes, sorry, they've drifted away.
They've had a reorganisation. Instead of being it was a council of, I don't know how many people, a dozen or 15 or so, with little working groups. It started off, I think, four working groups of focusing on, you know, specific subjects like, and I can't remember, I haven't got them all in front of me, but things like people-related issues, and so they would look at one thing, or Brexit-related issues, or green things, or technology things. And these working groups would be trying to promote and push certain specific aspects of that Construction 2025 strategy.
Yeah.
Now what's happened is Construction 2025 strategy is sort of been parked, and we're all now about COVID recovery. And the whole focus and the whole language is build back better, greener, stronger after the whole COVID thing. And they set up this COVID task force. And the rationale behind what they've now done is the whole COVID recovery. Anyway, so what they've now got, they've got what they call a steering group, which is primarily, it's half, I suppose, trade associations. And actually, no, it's less than that. You've got Andy Mitchell, the boss of Thames Tideway, the Thames Super Sewer client organisation. He's the industry side co-chair of it, and the minister is the government side co-chair. And sitting on this coordination group, you've got, what, one, two, three, four, four people from trade associations, two people from surveyors, one person from MACE, who you might call a contractor, or you might call a surveyor, whatever you want to put it, but three people from industry, and a couple of civil servants. And then you've got a much larger task force group, which has got about 20 or two dozen people on it, which has got pretty much those same people, plus more people from trade associations and other quangos like Construction Innovation Hub, which is part of the Building Research Establishment, and the Green Construction Board, Health and Safety Executive, and these sort of things, plus a couple of other people from consulting engineers and surveyors, someone from Mott MacDonald and someone from Turner and Townsend, and these sort of people. But it's very, very, very trade association, quango, public servant, civil servant heavy, which you can sort of understand, because you know that if you put on, you know, Leo Quinn, the boss of Balfour Beatty, Ray O'Rourke from O'Rourke, and, you know, the boss of Skanska and the boss of Costain on these things, and said, you know, you've got to come to three meetings a month and do this, that and the other, they kind of go, right, yeah, I'm all for this.
What about the day job?
Actually, I'm a bit busy.
Yeah.
Whereas... These sort of people are actually on it now, bar perhaps a few exceptions, so I'm sure will forgive me, but there's a strong leaning on people whose job it is to go to meetings.
Yes, trade associations. They're there to fly the flag and have their voice heard. So
exactly that, and lobbyists.
Sure.
But then there's also a third group that's now been set up under the Construction Leadership Council ambit, called a senior advisors group. And here you have got some proper bosses. You have got Ray O'Rourke on this, and the boss of who we've got, Barratt Developments chief executive David Thomas. Actually, not that many. Gregor Craig from Skanska. So there are some proper bosses, some proper businessmen. But then again, you've got more trade association bods. This chap, Mark Farmer from Cast, who's the who wrote a government report on how everything should be built in factories instead of on site a year or two ago. He's in there, and a couple of academics, institution type people, mm-hmm. like, you know, I think we've got who's the Chartered Institute of Building are on there. Mm-hmm. But the most surprising person on here, it seems to me, is they've got the president of the TUC, Gail Cartmail, is now on the Construction Leadership Council Senior Advisors Group. Now, the idea that you would have union representation on the Construction Leadership Council 5 years ago would have been, I'm sure, welcomed by many people, but would have been extraordinary, would never have ever happened.
No.
So they've really cast the net wide. This is the point now of what they've done with Construction Leadership Council. Instead of being this select, tight little group mm-hmm. that can get things done and move fast and, you know, move quickly and get things done, it's come one, come all.
Yeah.
Just put your hand up. You know, anyone want to join? Anyone got time on
their
hand?
Well, I imagine there must have been lots of people out there who are represented now who felt that they'd been sidelined. I mean, the trades union, I'm sure, or trade unions, I'm sure, would have felt that they had a dog in this race, as a phrase goes, and that they needed to be consulted. They needed to have their voice heard. And the same goes for people in professional organisations and trade associations and stuff like that. They don't want to be left out.
Well, I've always said that the construction industry is about only three things. And if I'm allowed to use sexist language, because I can't think of a better one that begins with M: manpower, money and machinery.
Mm-hmm.
Now, manpower, of course, I mean person power.
Yes.
But manpower, machinery and money. And what we've got, I mean, to a certain extent there's money, there's no bankers here. There's certainly the human side, the personage of the construction industry is represented by the Construction Leadership Council. But it seems to me the whole topic of machinery, which is central to making the industry more efficient, and it's a big part of the UK's export drive and import for the construction industry, is completely absent in this. So the only people that don't seem to have got on board are the Construction Equipment Association, who represent the equipment manufacturers, and the Construction Plant Hire Association, who represent the owners. Now, you could argue, I believe the Construction Plant Hire Association are now a member of Build UK.
Mm.
And the Build UK boss, Susanna Nicol, is on the small top-level steering coordination group. So you could say that the Construction Plant Hire Association is involved by virtue of its membership of Build UK.
Yes.
But I don't think Build UK, I'm sure it serves all its members equally well, but it's so broad that I don't think it will be going in particularly with a digger driver's hat on.
No, indeed. But given time, you know, they might widen the net even further and get people who provide catering services to the construction industry in there in due course.
I think we should be pushing for the construction trade press to be on there, David.
Yes, I think so.
The voice of reason. You're going to have to go, though.
I'm not going to a monthly meeting up in London.
I don't want to go to
nice
meetings.
I found a quote about bureaucracy from Balzac, the French 19th century French novelist, who described a bureaucracy as a giant mechanism operated by pygmies, which I thought was rather good. I think the people at the Construction Leadership Council ought to just keep that in the back of their minds and try and avoid that sort of situation developing. But I suppose we'll see how they get on.
I'm not going to stand by your comment suggesting that any of these people are pygmies, because
no, indeed.
I might want them to talk to me one day. Not that they ever have yet, particularly. But it's an interesting list of people who are on these panels, on these councils or committees or whatever you want to call them. If you have a look at constructionindex.co.uk, we've headlined the story, Leadership Council Spreads Its Wings and Morphs Into Something Else,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of how I read it. But the names, you'll see that the trade associations have basically taken over from the bosses, is how I see it.
Yeah.
And that's because the trade associations are effectively the private sector civil servants, the trade association bosses is the way we can look at them. And they are good at meetings and minutes and relaying messages and staying on message and the politics of it all, and getting through it all. So that's what's going on there.
Yeah, okay. Anything else you want to discuss, Phil? I mean,
well, just, just, just briefly, we've covered an awful lot of ground there, but there was one thing I just wanted to touch on. We mentioned, I do hate this expression, modern methods of construction. I put up my garden shed yesterday that arrived, and clearly with our screwdriver, hammer, tacks, screws, this was modern methods of construction.
Indeed.
Nah. I think putting up a garden shed like that, there's nothing particularly modern about it, but it still seems to come under the remit of modern method of construction. But anyway, on the subject of this, interesting story this week. A lot of construction companies have invested heavily in off-site production of building components, of panels, of sections. And famous one, I think you can think of Lange O'Rourke, have got this big factory somewhere in, is it in the East Midlands? I can't remember exactly where it is.
Yes, I think it is.
And they call it, was it DVFMA, Design for the Manufacturing Value Added, something like that, whatever. And they've got their own specific jargon for what they do, that building big pieces of a building in a factory. So there are all sorts of different ways of going about it. Beard, a somewhat smaller contractor than Lange O'Rourke, have gone in completely the other direction, and they've invested in a company that make, well, essentially prefabricated buildings, but they look nothing like the kind of, you know, boxy porter cabin stacky type of units that one associates with prefabs.
They're rather smart, actually, aren't they? They're
kind of shishy. They look like the sort of, you might see it, glamping or in a holiday,
yes, exactly. Yeah,
what do you call it? Centre parks or something.
Yeah,
I mean, you've seen the pictures. What do you think? What do you think of the look of them? The aesthetic of these?
Well, they're different. What I do like about them, and whether or not I actually would want one in my back, actually, it looks too big to go in my back garden. But there's clearly some design gone into it. Somebody has thought we want it to look like this. It's got sort of curved walls. It's sort of around surfaces. It's Teletubby-ish.
It's like a Teletubby house.
It is a little bit.
That sounds rude.
I think it looks quite nice.
I'll tell you where I'd have that. I'd have that in one of those, you know, those, they must have loads around your way down in Devon, mobile static caravan parks that,
yes,
you have on top of cliffs overlooking the sea. And you think, oh, that'd be a nice place to live, but you're only allowed to spend 11 months a year there, and you don't get to own, it's only a lease on a whatever 20-year lease. But as a kind of a holiday, part-time holiday home, they'd be a beautiful, much, much nicer than a static caravan.
Yes.
And much grander, I suspect.
When people talk about prefabrication or off-site construction, I think most people, the mental image that springs into their mind is a porter cabin. I'm using the term generically, which of course porter cabin don't like, but that's what everybody thinks of. It's a site hut, basically. It's a rectangular box with no real attempt to make it.
The cost has been stripped out
pleasing.
Completely.
Yeah, exactly. It's space. It's volumetric. It's stuff.
It is
space.
What it is. Yeah.
And I think most people, when they, for as long as I've been writing about construction, people have been saying that off-site construction is the way to go. You know, you've got your quality issues, your safety issues sorted. It's all done in a factory. Bring it to site, whack it up, and off you go. You've got a building. And I think, I know that you're slightly less, well, I don't know, you're a little bit more skeptical about off-site construction than me, perhaps, but
I like masonry. I like bricks. I like stone. I'm a bit conservative.
And so do I. And what I don't like about off-site construction is off-site buildings which are made to look like they were built in situ. So, for example, you've got a house which looks like it's built out of bricks, but actually the bricks are only a centimetre thick. They're just slips, or they're prefabricated panels which have been made in a factory. I don't like things that are trying to look like something they're not. Whereas this thing, the sort of unit built by this company called Green Unit, which is the
yes, you should have mentioned
Beard.
Green,
yes,
Unit.
Yeah,
yes.
Green Unit. Where are they based? I can't remember. Oh,
I think Abingdon or Oxfordshire.
Oxfordshire, that's right. Yes, yeah.
Beard
are in
the
Bristol. Yeah. Anyway, their buildings aren't pretending to be in situ constructions. They don't look like a normal building for a start, and so I think there's a certain honesty in that, and I applaud that. And I think that, you know, there's no denying that you can get much more consistent and higher quality standards by building in a factory environment. You are definitely going to improve health and safety by reducing the number of operations which need to be done on site and at height. So those are big pluses, and there's no denying that. The biggest problem for most people is that a prefab looks like a prefab, and I don't want to live in one, or I don't want to work in one. But I think that actually off-site construction has a lot to offer. I just think you have to change your expectations. And when you are specifying a prefabricated building, you want something which is going to perform well. You want something which is going to look okay, but don't try and make it look like a Victorian house or an Edwardian municipal building or something like that. It's an off-site construction. It's a different sort of thing, and I think you've got to approach it from a different point of view. But equally,
it'd be nice if they didn't all look like travel lodges or student accommodation.
No.
Lowest common denominator tower blocks.
One of the areas where off-site construction has been a real success and is widely used is in things like student accommodation, hotels.
We said this before, things that people aren't going to put their mortgage into.
Yes, exactly. But where a rectangular box, which you can stack one on top of the other, is very flexible. It's like Lego, so you can build these structures quite easily. And I suppose maybe that's the problem, that you can't really get away. You can't have a nice curved structure like these green unit buildings on large scales and scale it up and down to suit the site, because you can't really stack something like this very easily. I wouldn't have thought. You certainly couldn't stack them side by side.
I think the thing is most off-site construction, prefabricated, MMC, whatever you want to call it, I would put in the category of good enough for purpose, fit for purpose.
Yeah.
These buildings that Green Unit are putting out, I would actually call them desirable. And on that basis, I wonder how economic, how good a business proposition they are.
Yeah.
How many people are going prepared to... it must cost more than a plain box would cost, or a tin container, shipping container converted into a site hut. But you might want it. But the point is that Beard have got a market in the health sector and schools and whatever. So if a school and, I can certainly imagine a private school, if that's got deeper pockets, wants a little bit of extra space, which is a little bit more attractive than a 40-foot shipping container, Beard now has something on the back of a wagon it can give you tomorrow by investing in this company.
Yeah.
And it's a different way to go, isn't it? Rather than going the boxy route or whatever, or even the higher tech route that I suppose Lang O'Rourke might have gone. What I call the grand designs route, the Kevin What's-His-Space type of thing. I wish Beard luck with it, but I don't think it's going to make them gazillions. I think they're aiming too high.
Well, we'll see. I think I take your point that maybe a school might want to invest in something like this, because I know you didn't go to the sort of school where they had mobile classrooms on the playing field, which is the sort of school I went to. But we did. We had these boxy things which were still on wheels. They were still there years after I left school. I mean, decades after I left school. They're supposed to be temporary. They were always called the temporary classrooms, but they were anything but temporary. They are pretty permanent. Well, you see, something like this, if a school wants space quickly and it can't afford a permanent build, get something like this. And it doesn't matter how long it's there for, because it looks great. And, they're not intended as temporary buildings. These are permanent buildings, and
this is a permanent structure. Yes.
Yeah. So I'd say go for it. Again, as you pointed out, cost will be an issue, and I don't know whether one of these costs less than a permanent building would cost. An in situ building rather would cost.
One thing I can anticipate happening, which might be a shame but might be necessary, is as soon as. I mean, Beard's not exactly a big corporation, is it? It's a family firm. But it's conceivable that when big construction gets its hands on the green unit's designs, that they'll try and value engineer it to something, and these nice round edges might start becoming a bit squarer,
a bit sharper. Yeah.
Things might change.
Who knows? Well, anyway, there's some nice pictures on our website, www.theconstructionindex.co.uk.
Beard buys into modular building firm.
Yeah.
Looking for that.
So if you want to see what they look like, go there and find out. Yeah. Have we done it?
We've been talking far too long. Talking of hot air and meetings, maybe we should join the Construction Leadership Council, Dave.
Yeah, I think we should. I'll look out for my invitation.
It only remains for me to say thank you, people, for once again listening to Reconstruction, to David and myself. We will be back again next week, but do get in touch if you've anything you would like to hear us talk about or tell us about, more to the point. Email us at podcast@theconstructionindex.co.uk. So, thank you very much. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.